Okay, so I'm going to talk about some of our recent efforts trying to reconstruct the transcription network in yeast. So I'm going to focus on yeast. Several speakers this week talk about transcription networks, including fly and yeast, etc. So I hope by this time that you are convinced that based on the rapid accumulation of lots of large scale data, the problem of studying transcription network become tractable. And in my optimistic view that in the next few years, maybe we'll get a much more comprehensive picture about the transcription network in single organism like yeast. I don't know how long it will take to get a comprehensive picture of understanding for transcriptional circuits in system like fly. So let me start with very simple cartoon kind of picture for the regulating networks in, for example, in yeast. Yeast has to deal with tasks that will be much simpler than a system like fly has to deal with. So typically, it has to respond to different environmental conditions and adjust its expression and to deal with it. So this is a simple picture where the cell is subject to various different environmental conditions, and the cell senses it by some signaling pathway, and that signaling path, typically the end point of that signaling pathway will be some change of transcription factor activity. In this case, under low phosphate condition, the signaling pathway eventually make it phosphorylate. Actually, dephosphorylate this protein and called 4-4, which is a transcription factor, and then this transcription factor move into nucleus and target a whole bunch of genes. And these genes are typically phosphate transport and storage genes. So similarly, for heat shock and amylase starvation, there are pathways that turn on different transcription factors, which in turn tone the transcriptional response of the genome. So in a conceptual simplified framework, we will see that, so people have done lots of micro experiments. They look at how the whole genome responds to various conditions. So in a simplified conceptual framework, so here we have like experimental conditions that could be environmental stress or some change genetic perturbations to the cell. And these will be taken as input. And what microarray data typically tells us are the transcriptional state of the genes in the genome. So what we observe are the gene expression data for all the genes in the genome under different conditions. We call this gene expression matrix. What is missing from that data is actually in the middle, you can imagine that in a very simplified picture, there's a middle layer that corresponds to various regulators, transcription factors. So these factors can be turned on or off, depending on conditions. So I call this transcription factor state for physicists, basically. And these transcription factors, then they target different genes in the genome. So I call this activation matrix, which tell you under different conditions which factor gets turned on or off. You can do that more quantitatively. See, David yesterday, I actually was trying to use a continuous variable to fit this activation matrix. And then this factor target different genes, I call this connectivity matrix. So this is a simplified picture. So what cell has to do is that have to solve some, like what I think conceptually, the two layer of design problem. One is that the cell has to design various signaling pathways, signaling networks, to basically convert this input, which are external conditions, into the state of transcription factor. So that's the first kind of design. And then it has to, at the second layer, it has to deal with the problem of design. Given different transcription factor states, namely on or off of different transcription factors, and convert that input into the transcriptional level, transcriptional response of all the genes in the genome. This box is cis regulatory logic. So if you expand that box of cis regulatory logic, you actually see this whole box is designed by combinations of DNA motifs sitting in front of a promoter in the promoter of different genes, and taking transcription factor state as input.
The transcription factor themselves also regulated by this regulator.
Yeah, so there are feedback loops. I'm just simplifying this. But conceptually, you still can say these genes encoding transcription factor themselves, right? So this is a complete set of regulatory regions for every genes in the genome, where you design various combination of motifs. So this is the whole cis regulatory logic box, where it takes input from transcription factors and output the transcription level of the genes. So somewhat grand goal for trying to understand transcription networks is that, well, this is very ambitious, trying to dissecting all the signaling pathways. Therefore, you are able to predict that what is the transcription factor state from various contingent conditions for the cell. And this is, I think, largely it's experimental work. And then the second step that you try to decipher cis regulatory logic, namely try to understand how the logic functions, the one I just showed before that convert input of transcription factor state into the transcription level of genes, how that logic is encoded in the sequence by using combination motifs. And of course, for physicists, we are not happy with just getting the details of how each gene is regulated. We also want to understand what are the fundamental constraints and the design principles for this signaling pathway and cis regulatory logic. You can imagine there are various constraints due to physics and chemistry, because the way all these things have to work subject to laws of physics and chemistry. But then there are also evolutionary design principles. This network has to be robust, they have to be evolvable, and given, for example, given the total number of available transmission factor, how many states you want to design, etc. So this kind of general question. So for the ease of discussion, I'd like to define some simple terms here, which I call the transcription module. It not necessarily qualify as a module. If Lewis will ask me how to define the module has to have certain modularity. If you plug in different places, it has to do similar thing. But I will claim that this transcription module does not satisfy that criterion, but just for the ease of discussion. A transcription module is defined as a transcription factor, the binding sites of the transcription factor, the recognition profile, and the genes that are directly regulated by this transcription factor. That's what I mean by the transcription module. So use that module definition, you can either further simplify the cartoon picture of signaling pathway. You can see under different conditions, I activate different modules, and these modules probably overlap with each other. They can talk to each other. So somewhat modest goal, which I think is achievable in the next few years, is that we can try to determine the structure of transcription modules on a genomic scale. Figure out transcription factor, the binding size, the target gene, et cetera, given a large amount of data available. Then we can try to identify conditions on which these modules are activated, kind of instead of trying to predict transcription factor states from external signal based on knowledge on that complicated signaling pathway, we can try to infer the conditions on which these modules are activated. And then we also are interested in studying the interaction overlaps of these modules and try to get some idea how, in general, combinatorial control is achieved. So the kind of data we use, of course, genomic sequence, multiple species. We haven't done anything in comparative sequencing in that area. So we have data on genome sequence plus gene annotation. There are large number of gene expression data for cell under different conditions. And there are lots also gene expression data for genome expression profile for mutants, like when you delete a gene or you overexpress some gene, you can also look at the transcription profile. And then very recently, there's this data chip on chip, which Ren talked about yesterday. So Ricky and staff did some systematic study about 100 or so transcription factors using chip. So this is the basic steps. So I'm going to focus more on the algorithm part. So these are the basic steps I'm going to talk about. The first step that we're trying to use this microdata, either a deletion, gene deletion experiment or some kind of environmental stress or chip on chip, whatever, and try to first detect a core regulatory motif recognized by a particular transcription factor using an algorithm called Reduce, which is developed in collaboration with Harman. I guess Harman is going to talk more about this maybe tomorrow, and Eric. So we use this first to detect the core regulatory motif from large number of data. And then we try to construct transcription module. The goal here is that try to identify binding site, the genes, as accurately as possible that are directly regulated by the transcription factor. For that purpose, we develop an algorithm called MODEM, which I will discuss. And then the next step is that once we have this module, we can try to identify or infer conditions under which these modules are activated. So for that purpose, we develop a local similarity search algorithm for finding similarities between gene expression profile that share certain local, I will make that clear, what do I mean by local, characteristics in the gene expression data. We use that to infer under what conditions different transcription factors are active. And finally, we have a good list of these modules. We are in the process of looking at the overlaps between these modules and combinatorial control. That's the steps. So first, let me just briefly talk about how do we use Reduce to analyze various microdata. So the basic idea of Reduce is that you take a log of gene expression data and you write it as a product of two matrices. You can call this activation matrix or this connectivity matrix. But in the Reduce framework, we simply use the number of motifs, say some kind of putative motifs in front of the gene G as the connectivity matrix, and then try to basically fit this activity matrix as a fitting coefficient. This is basically multiple multivariate linear regression algorithm. So this is, I still didn't get rid of this R. Regulatory element detection uses correlation with gene expression called Reduce algorithm. The idea is that you just focus on putative binding sites. You actually can enumerate this and do this fit. This is a fitting where the NWG is the number of recurrence of a specific motif W in gene G's promoter. And this fitting coefficient tells you how strong overall this site correlates with the gene expression data for a given experiment T. That's a fitting formula. And you do that iteratively. So you do that iteratively. Basically, you scan for all the oligos. At the first step, you scan for all oligonucleotides that correlate strongest with the gene expression data. You pick that one, you say, this is motif one. And then you subtract the contribution from that motif. You look at the next strongest, you look at the residue of that fit and ask who is correlating strongest with this residual fit, and you keep going on cycle, iterate.
Do you care about the number of motifs, let's say,
what?
Motif is present in one, less than zero. Is that a
word? It works less well as you compared to taking the copy number into account. Yeah.
You mean non-overlapping number?
Non-overlapping number. Okay. Okay, this algorithm has a few interesting features. One is that it certainly does not depend on clustering of genes because you analyze this per microarray experiment. You take one microarray experiment, you do the fit. So you don't need to cluster genes because the basic idea is that if you cluster gene, your conception is that these genes fall into disjoint class, each controlled by one factor. So in this way, you can get combinatorial motifs. And the sign of fit tells you whether factor is inducing or repressing expression. But of course, one of its limitations is that this algorithm can only identify the highly conserved core motif of the binding site of a transcription factor. So we apply this first, as the first step, we apply this to a large number of data, including Mainly gene deletion experiment. This is actually Rosetta data made available publicly. And many environmental stress response, time course, proliferation, phosphate metabolism, cell cycle, etc. So this is a picture of, for example, stress response, where this axis is gene, this axis is different conditions, and you use MacEisen's program to cluster, and you see genes go up and down under different conditions. So you have seen this already multiple times. So if we use reduce to analyze this kind of data set, we get lots of motifs. Many motifs you find that corresponds to known ones. For example, in general, you find this stress response element in all different environmental stress conditions. You find this called MCB box for under cell cycle conditions, the NDTAT binding site under sporulation conditions, the 4-4 binding site for various perturbation of phosphate response pathway. So we get most of the known stuff. And for example, if you apply this to amyloidosis starvation time course, you get a large number of motifs here. That's consistent with the idea that amyloidosis starvation turned down lots of genes in the cell. It's a very wide cellular response. And actually, we recognize a few motifs here. For example, the stress response element, the motif that recognized by this complex, MET4, MET31 complex, that is responsible for turning on genes for methionine synthesis, and this famous master regulator G7-4, the binding site for G7-4. So you get all these core motifs, lots of them. Could be, if it's strong enough. You can pick one end of it. Actually, I have one example for that.
So in this case, I noticed that G7-4 is not the strongest gene.
It's not, right, this. You see, the strongest is stress response.
Is it the stress response?
Yeah, the stress response element is strongest. Actually, this is a stress response element. Right? So far, I guess nobody found which factor is actually bound here. But this one occurs in many different stress response experiments. This one corresponds to a motif that's responsible for general repression of a large number of genes during under stressful conditions.
It's the one that is upstream in long ribosomal RNA.
Yeah.
Process.
I guess
that one that's minus 38, the GAP guy, those are the ones that I talked about.
CGTGO. Yeah, so there are lots of known motifs, and there are also many novel motifs.
Sorry, I missed. How did you find these motifs?
Oh, this is by running the reduced program. This is linear regression.
This is a combination with the gene expression data?
Yeah, you take all these amyloidosis starvation time course, and you analyze them. You use reduce. So another class of experiment of the data we analyze, we call transcription factor perturbation experiment. So basically, you take wild type and you take a mutant that either has a transcription factor deleted or have a transcription factor mutated so that it's constitutively expressed or like with high level. In the case that, for example, for 4-4 case, people make mutations so that 4-4 will constitutively goes to nucleus. So that this kind of perturbation, and you compare to MRI sample and you see that genes go up and down. So this is kind of transcription factor perturbation experiment. And we use reduced algorithm to analyze this experiment. We find that in many cases where the transcription factor is characterized, in most of the cases transcription factor are characterized, the most significant motifs identified by reduced is actually the regulatory motif recognized by that factor. And I can show you a table here. So in the Rosetta data, there are a total of 28 transcription factors among that 300 gene deletion experiment. So we did that for all these 28. And you see that, for example, G7-4 deletion, you strongly pick up this binding site that, of course, agrees with the known G7-4 binding site. And this is MBP, so et cetera. So this table just shows you for most of these transcription factors that we know, what binding site they bind to, the reduced pickup, the motif that agrees with the known.
TF is a transcription there.
TF is transcription factor. So these are all transcription factor. And these are highly...
FAL4 is a transcription factor.
This is a transcription factor, yeah.
Transcription factor,
yeah. Yeah, this is a transcription factor. And this is the binding site we picked by the reduced algorithm, and this is the known characterized binding site. And it controls phosphate metabolism. Okay, so that's first step. So we use this reduced algorithm. We systematically analyze all this data, including our chip-on-chip data, which I will talk in a few minutes. But after we pick up this core motif, we want to accurately construct what are the target genes controlled by this factor, and what's the better definition of the binding site. So for that purpose, we develop an algorithm called MODEM, which I'm going to discuss. So the basic idea here is that suppose you find a core motif and you want just use a core motif to define the target gene. It's highly non-specific, right? For example, this, we know this site, CACGTGG, is a binding site for 4-4. But if you search the whole genome, you find 137 genes actually contain at least one copy of this motif. And roughly 15 genes are true target of 4-4. So you see that if you just use this motif as a definition, you get...
How do you know what a true target is?
Because there are separate experiments to define them.
But you're not going to describe
it. Yeah, I'm going to describe it. And then we know there are certain target genes which doesn't have this exact core motif. It can have one or two mutations in its core region. So if you take into account mutations, then the situation is getting worse, right? If you say, I'm going to search for genes with one mismatch to this core motif, I'm going to get about 2,000 genes in the genome with one mismatch. So how do you gain specificity without losing sensitivity? The idea is that actually there are additional information you can use. One information is that there are still information contained in the flanking region surrounding that core motif. And second is that we have to use the gene expression data again, right? Because this is what you get at the first place, how you get that core motif, but you can also use gene expression data. So I'm going to describe to you an algorithm that combines this information to improve both specificity and sensitivity. So the idea is that if you look at core sequence, say call them sequence 1 to n, and the algorithm, the input to this algorithm is that you have a core sequence, and then you have the gene expression data for each gene. As the output of this algorithm is that actually calculate the probability of each gene being a target, and then classify gene into the target or non-target category. So whether it's a true target or not. And for that purpose, we use a joint probability model that models a sequence and gene expression data. So for the expression data, we use a very simple model. We see that, well, there are background. If you look at all the non-target genes, suppose you take the 4-4 core binding site and you see, let's find all the genes that have one mismatch to that core motif. So you look at all these genes, most of them are just background hits, false positives. So there are some kind of distribution for its gene expression level, and we model that by Gaussian. And then you see if it's a true target, then it has to be distributed somewhat differently, and that's modeled by a different Gaussian distribution. And then besides these two Gaussian distributions, you also need two weight matrices to describe the motif and background sequence. So two weight matrices, and they are both position-specific weight matrices. I guess most people heard about this multiple times. It's basically a table of frequencies of currents for each base at different positions, and which reflect the preference for the protein that recognizes the site. And so in this model, you have two different position-specific weight matrices. One describes the true target, and another one describes the non-target genes. And then you have also a mixing parameter. So this problem just become a demixing problem, right? Where if you pool these genes with the motif with one mismatch, you get a large number. You want to see which one is real, which one is not. So you try to demix them based on gene expression data as well as sequence profile. The idea is that suppose you start at the beginning, you just look for matches, and you pull these genes. You look at genes with high expression value. They are more likely to be true target, right? And then you look at the flanking region. There are additional information. So use that additional information to really pull the sample. You get a better idea what they look like. And you keep doing that. So this is a typical GM algorithm, right, with the probability model. And this lambda basically describes the mixing. It's a mixing fraction, like how many of those are actually true target.
But one could imagine a lot of the mixing information comes from distinct sites rather than contiguous.
You mean multiple sites? Yeah, so we are not operating at that level. But so this is just still a single one body, but it does pretty well. So in the model, basically you have some probability parameters, like I described the Gaussian parameters for two Gaussian distribution, the position-specific weight matrix, and this lambda parameter. It's all parameters in the model. And you basically write down a joint probability for sequence and expression data, and then try to maximize the posterior probability distribution. So the hidden variable or the missing value is actually you don't know which one is target, which one is non-target. But you can write down a posterior probability for the parameters given the observed sequence and expression data, and then try to maximize it. Okay, but with a number of simplified assumptions, assume that sequences are independent for different promoters, and also assume that once you know this is a target, there's no strong coupling between the gene expression value and the sequence profile score. Okay, so I'm going to skip some of the math here. Basically, the posterior probability can be written as a product for different sequences. So this term tells you the probability for it being a target. Lambda tells you the prior probability, and this is the distribution function for expression data, and this is distribution for the sequence, and you do that also for the non-target term. Anyway, for people interested in more detail, we can discuss afterwards. But basically, once you solve this model by iteration, which statisticians call expectation maximization algorithm, you get a p-value for each target gene, and you can classify them.
Essentially, like a Fermi distribution.
Somehow, for some unknown reason, goes to the end. Let's see. I hit some key, I guess. Somewhere 20. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a mixture model. Okay, so is this the formula you're talking about here? So this put one slice further, right? So this is understood, right? This term is the probability for being a target. This is probability for being a non-target. So you add them together. And for the classification, this is basically the ratio of the two, right? This is probably being target, and this is being target, this is being non-target. So you solve all these parameters by EM. Okay.
So do you have any examples of how the motif model differs between the targets and the non-targets?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is the first example I want to show, but I don't have that profile matrix data here. I certainly can show you. For this one, I can't describe them. This is an example where, this is a 4-4 example, right? I think this thing cut off somewhere here. The core motif you identify from reduced algorithm is CACGTGG, right? And we know many 4-4 target genes have mismatches to that core motif. So for constructing module here, we allow one mismatch. So you go to the genome, you pull out about 2,000 genes with one mismatch. And then you just run this modem algorithm, which is basically classifier. So at the end, that the modem algorithm actually predict. So one good thing about this algorithm is that there's no fiddling with the cutoff, right? If you just look at gene expression, you see cutoff of 2-fold, 1.5-fold, etc. Here you don't have a choice. There's an objective choice for the cutoff, for that, because the mixing parameter is calculated automatically. So here the algorithm predict total 24 of the genes as the 4-fold target. And the rest of the 2,000 basically is non-target. And you see that we got, unfortunately, this thing cut off another whole column here, because these are the genes we predict from the modem algorithms. And these are the genes, there are actually two independent experiments. One done by Ogawa et al. From, this is Pat Brown's group. And another group by Aaron O'Shea's lab at UCSF. So they did an independent experiment, and they characterized the 4-fold target gene. And you see that most of these genes we predict agrees very well with their prediction. So
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused about this. What's the training set and the test set?
There's no training set. So, okay, I didn't explain clearly. The only data we use here is the 4-fold gain of function mutation data. So it's some kind of mutation that makes 4-fold constitutively goes to nucleus. And this is just one microdata. Right? You compare this mutant with the wild type. That's it. You get a ratio for every gene. That's the data we operate now. No other information. Just one single gene mutation data. And this is the target we figure out, right? By these two steps. One, run, reduce, and then run this modem algorithm. And we pick up most of the genes that they know. We missed about four of them. Target.
Are those experimentally different sites, each one of the genes, or traditionally,
The OCS experiment defines the target of 4-fold by various perturbations of, so they actually did a number of perturbations and then do microarray experiment.
So that was based on microarray?
That's based on microarray. And so they did various perturbations at different parts of that pathway, starting from 480, 481, and goes down. And then basically lump all the genes that have similar response. Where you expect the response from 4-4, the true target of 4-4, how that respond?
It's important to have probably sequences in this.
Is
there some parameter to say how long?
Oh, how long, yeah. So that's a little bit arbitrary. In these runs, we typically take about 7 base on both sides. So the core motif is 7 base, so you get 7 base on left and right. So total is about 21 base pair now. So you take this whole piece.
Is this fixed throughout the program, or you vary the length?
You can actually say that 7 is even too much, because once you run this program, you look at profile, a few bits away, you see that profile actually decays to background. Right? You have a profile, because this algorithm tells you several things. It tells you probability of being target. It also gives you the profile matrix for the target as well as non-target. So this goes back to Gary's question. If you look at two profile matches, the non-target profile matches is basically no information at all once you move out from the core region. And the target profile matches has lots of information in the flanking region.
Yeah, I figured that, but I'm also interested in what happens within the core region. When you picked out all the sites that are one mismatch away from
right.
the consensus sequence, it could well be that the ones that you finally identify as being true sites
right.
are conserved in
in the core region.
The non-true sites would have variability in other, in the ones that are
yes. So in the core region, you do pick up profiles that prefer certain bases. And we have an example for GCN4 that you see that at the middle, if you look at different characterized sites, it has a strong preference for two different bases, and you did pick it up.
Although you're looking for flanking sequences that seem to specify the target selection, I do not just roughly fetch, I do not see a strong signal on flanking sequences.
Unfortunately, I did not put that profile matrix here. You see that there's actually some quite strong preference on G and A.
Okay.
write links to it. GA, GTA, yeah, GA. You see a whole bunch of GA proceeding, CAC, GTG. Actually, we do have that profile matches, but I didn't bring, didn't put it in here. We actually calculate the information content in the flanking region. So the total information content in the flanking region is about 4 bits. So that says roughly corresponds to 2 additional conserved bits if you look at the flanking region. So that really increases a lot of specificity because 4 bits can really lock down your target by a factor of 1/16.
So you have 2 distributions of the expression in the log ratios, right?
Right.
So the set of the targets was defined by the one mismatch set of genes?
The initial set is the set defined by every genes with promoter match this version of motif with one mismatch.
Right. So presumably you could not get the set of top targets predicted by this and redefine this distribution and somehow...
Exactly. That's actually how the EM algorithm works, right? Because when you do expectation maximization, the actual iteration step is that you first start with no knowledge, and then you basically, in the first step, you align every gene, right? Because at the beginning, you don't know what's the profile. You align every gene, and there's a very weak tendency for the bias towards the true profile, because out of all this, there's still a subset of gene that does have that flanking region profile, and that bias grows gradually as you do expectation maximization state.
I'm not trying to propose to use chromatin IP, but I'm just curious whether you have any independent evidence.
Yeah, so the yes, that's what I'm going to talk about. See, for the 4-4, the chromatin IP is totally crappy because essentially it doesn't get any known target. From the chromatin IP data, and for good reason, I believe, right? Because this 4-4 stays out of nucleus under normal conditions, so they just don't bend. But there are a number of factors that we have both deletion and chromatin IP data we can compare. And for example, the GCN4 case, they largely overlap. Okay, so for GCN4, this is another example. This is GCN4 module we construct from a single GCN4 deletion experiment. Right? This is also data from Rosetta. You delete GCN4 and you compare wild type with the mutant. And so we run these 2 steps. We first identify core motif and then run the module. And the module identified total 53 genes in the GCN4 module. And you can see among these 53 genes, a large number of them has something to do with amino acid metabolism or amino acid biosynthesized. So there's a very strong overlap with what we believe GCN4 is doing. GCN4 is regulating amino acid synthesized. And then many of these genes are actually shown by individual experiment that they are regulated by GCN4, many of these target genes. Because this is such a well-understood, well-studied case. I will not say a well-understood case. Many of these target genes are actually studied carefully by different labs.
I remember for the GCN4, even you take the ratio random on height, take the top and just do simple calculation, you'll get
it. Yeah, I think this is probably an easy case, yeah.
GCN4 is
Right, so GCN4 is a strong case. Just as you said, if you have a very strong data, then it probably doesn't matter what algorithm you use, right? But in the borderline case, this algorithm does make a difference. And one example we have here is the SOM1 chip-on-chip data. I'm going to talk a little bit.
Multiple sites play the role in borderline case.
Or even that, for example, if we talk about chip-on-chip data, you can have genes that you can have tendency of target genes have slightly higher ratio, but they are not ranked among say top 20. In that case, you cannot get them, right? You cannot get them either by ranking or by say the cut of pick the top 20 and run motif finding algorithm, you cannot get it. Okay. So many of these genes, as I said, many of these genes we found in the GCN4 module are annotated to be induced or replaced by GCN4 by individual experiment. And then we have prediction for some new genes here, which need validation. So we predict total 14 new target genes in this module, and most of these offs have unknown function, so obviously these have to be tested, and if someone is interested in testing them, I feel there's a need to have your in-house lab for people doing bioinformatics. So, I mean, it's sometimes, you say that you can convince a few people to do a few experiments, but your agenda and their agenda has to agree, right? Like, everyone has their own priority list.
Oh, I just wondered for these unknown marks, have you tried like an interprobe search or any kind of
that? For protein domains, we haven't.
Yeah. Any bioinformatic way at least of predicting that function?
No, we haven't done that. Okay, so based on all the 28 transcription factor perturbation experiment, we build all the modules for this transcription factor perturbation experiment, and that predict new binding site and target genes. So we also apply this methodology to analyze the chip on chip data from recently came out from Rick Young's lab. So the two criteria we look at this data. So we first run for all the chip data run reduced algorithm. Some of the experiment you pick up a strong motif, some of the experiment you just don't pick strong motif, right? And then there are cases where you pick a strong motif. So the way we do it is that we first use reduce to pick the core motif, and then use module to modem algorithm to construct module. We look at two criteria. One is that do we have a strong motif in the sense that it has reasonable length and has a reasonable p-value. And then the second criterion is that when you look at module, because most of these transmission factors are actually analyzed, we know what they do, right, in terms of its biological function. So we compare the biological function of the transmission factor to the functions of the genes in that module we constructed. And if they agree, so this is purely done by hand annotation, if they agree, we say this is a good case, because we find a strong motif and we find agreement between the genes regulated by, putatively regulated by that factor and the function of that factor. So by that criteria, this table is not intended for you to read. We get total 35 of what we call the high quality data or high quality factor case based on that, based on our criteria. And these all have strong motifs. I mean, some of these factors you actually can compare with the non-regulated motifs in the database. And we see that they all, for these cases that are listed here, they all agree. And then you look at the function of the factor, you ask that, do I get the genes that are related to the function of the factor? For example, this is an example where arrow 80, I think this line is shifted. The function of the factor is called is aromatic amino acid synthesized. And the genes induced by that, genes that we identify in the module are in fact many of them are responsible for synthesizing aromatic amino acid. So this is just one case. So some general statistics that out of, if you compare the recurrence data with the YPD data, you see the out of 106 factors they study, actually there are 70 of them in YPD with at least one example of regulatory target. Right? So total number of targets is 800 in the YPD for the 70 factors, and out of 800 known target sites or target gene, if you take their cut of 10 to the minus 3, they pick up totally 154 out of about 800 examples here. So that roughly give you a gross estimate of the false negative rate. And then you ask that what are these the factors that young data and YPD agree, at least for one target gene. There are total 39 of them. So these are the factors that there are data in the YPD and at least one target is picked up by the Rick Young's data, Young's data. And then we look at what's the overlap between these factors and the factors that we believe are good based on the criteria I described. You see, we need a strong motif, we need to have a consistent module function of the module with the factor, and the overlap is 25. So 39 factor from here and 35 factors from our study, the overlap is 25. So that says largely the ones that pick up the target in the database actually were picked up by our criterion to be a good case.
Oh, on the Young website, there's a quality control measure for each experiment. And the 300 or below is supposed to be good, and they range from like 400 to 12. Mm-hmm. So there are some experiments that, according to the measurements, were very good.
I don't know exactly how do they do that quality control being, you know?
It's probably new offering. I don't know.
I think there's some, I don't remember the details. I think there's some discussion on that. I was curious, have you looked at that? Does that bear any relationship?
This data, I produced this data last night, so we haven't had a chance to. Many of this stuff we are still working on.
YPD,
we got data, actually Sigar Maslow gave us the data. I don't know. They actually, I think they did some curation also. They did annotation curation. So YPD is no longer free. So the data that is Kim Slippen and Sigar Maslow.
One of the figures is also on the website. Actually about 1,000.
Yeah, 1,000 known cases. Yeah, the total case is about 1,200, I think,
so
in YPD. Okay, so quickly to summarize this part, we use modem algorithm to identify a target gene of a particular transmit factor. With kind of high specificity and sensitivity, we predict new target genes, and that can help annotate gene function. So these modules that we construct, we believe these genes are direct target of a transmit factor. These are based on transmit factor perturbation experiment or chip-on-chip data. So the next step is that once we construct this module or identify the motifs that are related to different transmit factor, we also want to identify cellular conditions under which these transmit modules are actually active. This is kind of the step where you, instead of trying to predict transmit factor states, right, from cellular stimuli, which involves a large part of a known cellular transduction pathway, we try to infer the state of transmitting factor from microarray data. And the idea is that you can define a local similarity measure. Well, this is kind of data, right? We have this transmitting factor perturbation experiment. We have this chip-on-chip data, give you transmitting factor location data. And then we have various microarray experiments under different cellular conditions. So now we want to infer the state of transmitting factor, i.e. identify conditions under which a particular transcript module is activated. And the way we do that is that we actually compare the gene expression profile of the transcript factor perturbation experiment, all chip-on-chip data, with the microarray data under appropriate condition. Right? So let's say I want to know if 4-4 is active under amyloid starvation condition. So I want to compare these two microarray expression data. But I don't want to compare in a global sense, because I know there's, in general, there will not be global similarity, because what I'm looking for is just the response of a subset of gene that may be regulated by this transcription factor. So we do some local similarity comparison. So this is the idea. For example, if you look at 4-4 mutation microarray data, I compare that with some other cellular condition called hypoosmotic shock. This is just made up example, but as I will mention that we in fact identify that this guy is active under this condition, which is somewhat unexpected. And the comparison is that you want to, let's say in general, these two microarray data are very different. There's no reason for them to be globally similar, but then there are some local similarities. So if you, for example, if you focus on the target gene of 4-4, they may behave very similar. So some kind of notion of local similarity, where locality is defined by common target of certain transmit factor. Right, so there's this local similarity search between two profiles. And one very simple way that we did is that we basically translate the gene expression data to some other gene expression data with weighting put on it. like weighted by motif. For given gene G under condition T, we want to know if anything interesting happened for transcription factor targets, and assume M is the target, the binding site for that transcription factor. We basically weight this expression data by the say number of copies that matches to that motif. So that's the way you try to emphasize genes with the target sites and de-emphasize the genes without the target site. That's one way to do local similarity. And there are many other ways to do it. And we are also working on taking gene expression data, construct different modules, and then cross-compare these modules with the module we already have to see how much overlap they have. So that's another way of doing it. Anyway, so this is a local similarity search we use. Okay, let me try to explain this. We have a profile. For example, we want to know under what conditions G74 is active. So we have a gene expression data for G74 deletion. And then we compare, for example, we want to know is G74 active under amyloid starvation condition. So we compare this profile with these profiles. And but we only focus on the genes that have at least one copy of the G74 binding site. So that's the local similarity comparison. And we scan this through all different experiments to identify conditions that this putative module is active. And the conditions we identify, again, this is cut off somehow. We identify that G74 is active under amyloid starvation condition, which is canonical. It has to be there. And we also identify G74 is active under nitrogen depletion. This is also related to the amyloid synthesized. And for the MBP1, which is an important cell cycle regulation factor, we identify that it's active in cell cycle. This is canonical. But we also identify a whole bunch of other conditions that this factor is active, such as dioxin shift and nitrogen depletion, etc. And we have another, we have a whole bunch of examples like steroid-12, for example. This is known to respond to pheromone, like pheromone induction in pseudohypho growth and also cell wall integrity. But we identify somewhat unexpected condition, which is nitrogen depletion. And if you look carefully in the literature, in the later stage of nitrogen depletion actually cause pseudohypho growth. So that kind of indicating steroid-12 is in fact play a role in the later stage of nitrogen depletion.
To what extent does the activity of transcription factor which you introduced that way correlates with expression of the transcription?
We haven't looked at expression because somehow we believe there's, I think in general people know there's no good correlation between the activity of transcription factor and mRNA level, because most of these transcription factors are regulated not by regulating RNA level, but instead by, say, phosphorylation or something like that.
Of course, but
We haven't.
With what you've done, one can actually compare the two, right? Because
yes.
You know, but we haven't looked at that.
We haven't done that.
I think one comment on that point is that in even the sort of simplest models, the relationship between protein and the transcript level. I mean, you're forgetting about all these other things and the fact that transcript factor activity is it may not be the total amount of protein or the amount of activated protein. A lot of the mass spec microarray experiments have just plotted, thrown a whole bunch of proteins up on a graph and said, look, they're all over the place. But if you sort of sit down and write out what a simple model would be, you find that actually the model is that there should be, you might expect, a linear relationship between the protein level and the transcript level, but the slope of that line would be different for each gene. So consequently, you can plot many genes on the same graph without making correction for that. You get a big scattering. You say, oh, highly expressed proteins aren't necessary, and that's true. There's no reason why an mRNA with a short half-life, okay, would necessarily correspond to a protein with a short half-life. And so you can have small amounts of transcript producing large amounts of protein. And
also the transcript level should mostly correlate with the derivative of a protein level,
in,
right?
In a steady state phenomenon, for any given gene, you expect a rough relationship. And actually, the graphs that I showed yesterday showed that actually addressed that question. to some extent, which show that the estimated transcript level, the transcript, measured transcript level for many of the transcription factors was strongly correlated with the estimated activity of the transcript across different experiments.
Your answer is it is correlated.
Yeah, there is something of a correlation. You have to be cautious.
It must be some very gross.
The slope of the line is different for different teams.
Maybe at environmental conditions, the degree of the environmental condition is more and more severe. And if you look at your contact, you leave amount of nitrogen, and you look at whether or not that transcription factor.
You mean, does that the activity level correlate with the level of the nitrogen depletion? I think they haven't done that for various level. It's only one time course data. Not enough level, yeah.
I think nitrogen starvation reduces meiosis
Does it induce meiosis? I don't know. This thing can be, this is thermal response or pseudo hypo growth.
Isn't nitrogen depletion extensively used in the lab to trigger this pseudo hypo growth?
Okay, so we do find that unexpected activation of these modules based on this local similarity comparison, which suggests that they may be functional. And so one case is that we found a strong evidence that the 4-4 targets in fact activated in the hypoosmotic shock experiment. So by that local similarity search. But you cannot find this by global similarity. So once you search, you find this, you take this target in the 4-4 and you carefully look at microdata, and you can see that these genes are also predominantly induced, mostly induced at the various time steps of hypoosmotic shock.
But if you clustered the hypoosmotic data, this would not have.
No, no way. It's just too small. So we actually construct module because in that hypoosmotic shock experiment, you can do the same thing. You can identify the motif and then use the modern algorithm to construct module. And this time we identify 11 genes instead of 24 genes that. Most of them are actually respond to 4-4 to phosphate starvation condition. So these genes are. So now that you see the modules are could be context dependent, the way we construct them, because we use not only sequence information, we also use the gene expression data. So the module you construct may have overlap, but they may break up into different parts. In this case, some of the other 4 genes are not induced under these conditions, but only part of this. 4 modules actually induced under this condition. Aaron O'Shea's lab is currently actually test whether 4-4 is active by itself. For example, by looking at locations, what does 4-4 translocate to nucleus under hypoosmotic shock conditions? So they're currently doing experiment like that. So this is basically the map. This result is that we published this a few months ago. At the time, we still don't have the chip data. So this is a map of the activation links for different conditions, like the environmental stress, based on only the transcription factor perturbation experiment. By that local similarity comparison, we figure out various factors that we believe are active under this condition. So this hexagons correspond to different conditions like hypoosmotic shock, amylase starvation, and these blues are the transcription factors we have deletion data. And then we also use this local similarity comparison method to look for what are the effects of gene deletions. But look at all these 300 single gene deletion micro experiments. For example, we want to know other genes that when deleted that can cause the activation of steroid-12. I mean, when Rosetta published this data, it's mostly focused on the pheromone pathway, right? Yeah.
Looking at the picture, am I supposed to think that these different transcription factors encode, perhaps in some combinatorial way, the effects of different conditions?
Encode different conditions.
How many conditions you have and how many factors you have, is this somehow deeply combinatorial code or?
From combinatorial from condition to factor. I mean, it's certainly combinatorial downstream from the regulatory regions to factor, from factor to regulate, to genes being regulated. Are you talking about combinatorial effect from environmental conditions?
Yeah, so you know, we have to somehow have to encode the n states of gene expression, right,
yeah,
corresponding to different conditions via the bottleneck of M transcription factors.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So presumably we have to start looking at some combinatorial combination of them. Or maybe there are many more.
There are lots of combinations. I mean, but I talk about two parts of design, right? The first part of design is that you need to design signaling pathway network, so that convert different environmental conditions.
I'm sorry, I think I'm asking a material question. Just looking at this, I can dream of cooking up some combinatorial code, right?
For genes regulated by these factors, you mean?
For conditions.
For conditions.
Right. So a different condition corresponds to activation
different
of
subset factors.
Of the transcription factors,
mm-hmm.
Right? In such a way, then the downstream regulated genes will not get confused, right?
But the problem is that you just don't have enough of.
We're just seeing a very small fraction of.
Yeah, we are certainly only seeing a small fraction of this.
Just many more transcription factors here.
I think what he is saying is true. Basically, looking at the activated transcription factor, you can guess what is the condition, the environmental condition that triggers it. Instead of the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So the simplest example, we take CC in the top left-hand corner. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I don't know what that is.
The cell cycle?
Sorry?
Cell cycle?
That's a cell cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to believe that there are only two transcriptions.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. This is certainly very sparse. I mean, there are, how many factors we look at? We like look at 28 of them. And there are probably 280.
And the transcription factors that I hear were really limited by, you had to pick the ones with strong signals.
Yeah, that's another filter. Yeah.
Most of them.
And plus, we only have a very small number of factors. We are going to redo this graph with the 35 factors that we believe are good data from the chip-on-chip data, and see how much we change this.
Why wasn't MCM1
connected to CC? MCM1?
No, MCM1.
MCM1. Simply just because we don't have that data in the deletion, in the TF transcription factor deletion experiment. Yeah, so that certainly can be weak. So this is a diagram that, this is the old diagram. We produce this data. This data is in the paper we published several months ago. So now by the same strategy, you can also look. How many time do I have? I'm going over time. So you can look at what genes, when you delete them, will affect a certain pathway. In this case, we focus on, we're comparing, we want to know what are the gene deletions that can affect the activity of steroid-12. right, which is the basic endpoint of that the downstream event of the pheromone response pathway. And the way we do that, we do the similarity comparison. We take all these deletion profiles and we compare with the STEL12 deletion profile. Again, focus on genes that are most likely to be the target of STEL12, right, by that motif weighting scheme. So now these are the pathways that people know that involves STEL12, the thermal response pathway, cell wall integrity, or high osmolarity response pathway. This one doesn't have STEL12, but this one, filamental growth, has STEL12. So we compare STEL12 deletion profile with all the other gene deletion profile available in that 300 gene deletion dataset. And so these are the genes we identified are highly similar to STEL12 deletion profile. So the green ones means that it's negative, meaning that if you delete these genes, you are going to see the depression of STEL12 targets. And the red ones mean it's positive. If you delete this gene, you are going to upregulate of STEL12 target. So this is all consistent based on this pathway here. You see, if you delete DIG1, 2, that basically release STEL12. So STEL12 target gets upregulated. And similarly for these genes, you see, if you delete one of those, you basically release DIG1, 2, which in turn repress STEL12, etc. So we basically map out the genes on these pathways that can have an effect when delete them will cause some change of transcription of STEL12 targets. But interestingly, we also pick up this gene, HOG1 here, which says that when you delete it, it actually affects STEL12. And this is a different pathway, right? This is high osmolarity pathway, which in general do not talk to pheromone pathway. But recently, Aaron Hershkovitz's lab did some experiment to show that if you release HOG1, if you delete HOG1, this actually causes crosstalk between HOG pathway and the STEL12 pheromone response pathway. They actually crosstalk once you delete HOG1. So that's actually one interesting prediction that is consistent with Aaron Hershkovitz's lab's recent experiment. And then we also have predicted many other genes which kind of look interesting. And we infer that deletion of this gene will also affect this pathway. But we don't know where to put them. So this is a potential way of discovering missing links in the pathway. But of course, the problem is that without further information on protein-protein interaction or pathway data, we don't know where to put them in the pathway. But certainly you can do experiment to verify if you do gene deletion, does it have phenotype? So finally, I'm going to just give a couple of examples that given that we carefully construct these modules, we now can look at the overlap between these modules and try to get some sense on combinatorial control. So identify genes co-regulated by more than one transcription factor and see if you see some combinatorial effect there. One example I'm going to show you is that we found a strong overlap between the modules construct for SOM1 and NDT80. We are doing this systematically. We're actually picking up lots of signals. And this is the one that we are pretty confident is correct. The SOM1 module, so SOM1 module is constructed from chip-on-chip data. So there's a SOM1 in that chip-on-chip data. We identify core motif GT, GT, CAC, and then we construct module, which consists of 67 genes. And for the NDT80 module, actually it's constructed differently. It's constructed from NDT80 deletion experiment. And we also construct this module in the sporulation time course. It's known that NDT80 is activated during sporulation. And so the module construct from NDT80 deletion largely agree with the module you construct from the sporulation time course. But interestingly, when we try to do this systematic overlapping study, like which module overlaps with which, we found that this module from construct from chip data strongly overlap with this module NDT80. And that's fairly interesting because you can then look at the genes that overlap. So as I mentioned, this module have 67 genes and this one have 88 genes. So there are a lot of middle sporulation genes that are controlled by NDT80, and there are lots of genes actually bound by someone because someone is known to be a general repressor. So now.
Overlapping in the upstream region.
What?
Overlapping in the upstream region.
No, gene. So we first look at gene, right? Because in this module we have 67 genes, and here we have 88 genes. And then we can look at how many genes overlap. And you see that there are total 17 genes overlap. But then we look carefully at the promoter region. We want to see where does it overlap, right? Because now you have two modules. Presumably, we can predict binding sites for the two modules. And we see that actually their binding site overlap. The someone has a GTGTCAC motif, while the NDT80 is known to have CACAAA motif. Now you see that there are three bases overlap between the binding site of two factors. And that's very interesting because these are the genes we picked up, and most of these genes have something to do with sporulation. Right? Especially that there's one target gene called NDT80 itself. So NDT80 regulated itself based on the module we constructed, but it's also regulated by someone, and this is something known before. People know that there's a competition for regulating NDT80, there's a competition between someone and NDT80, so that kind of like in the early stage of sporulation, someone is there. So it's basically shut off the expression of NDT80, and as the sporulation progresses, someone level drops, NDT80 come on, binds there, and turns itself on. So it's like positive feedback to turn on NDT80. That guarantees you have a fairly sharp profile at the middle of sporulation to turn on genes. But we get a whole bunch of other genes responsible for sporulation also have this overlapping binding site. So that's one example of this. Another example is that for amylase starvation time course, we actually construct several modules we believe are active. And then you can look at how the what are the genes that regulate. We see that there's a strong overlap between this MSN 2 and 4, which is a stress response factor, and this some other fact, which I think people don't know. These factors involved in amylase starvation response. And we see that the genes regulated by these two modules also have a high overlap. And if you look at these genes, they have on average much higher expression level than some other genes, which are regulated only by one factor. So basically, just want to summarize that we have built an algorithm to analyze transcription modules and look at their combinations or overlaps by these several steps. First, this reduced algorithm, and then this modern algorithm that refines the sensitivity, improves the sensitivity and specificity by using flanking region information as well as gene expression data. And we develop some local similarity comparison tool to identify transcription modules that are active under different conditions. And finally, we can look at the combination of these modules and look at overlaps between them. Thanks.
In that overlap example, have you looked at the expression profile?
We haven't. So this is fairly new. This overlap example that we just look at is just the past few days we were looking at this. But we want to do a systematic study of these overlaps. This is just one example. Another example I didn't mention is the cisplatin resistance gene, the SYN5 module, which strongly overlap with the general drug resistant module called the PDR13. So lots of examples like that. We just want to do it more systematically. So let me just acknowledge my collaborators. As I mentioned before, the reduced algorithm is developed in collaboration with Harman and Eric. And the modern algorithm is developed mainly in collaboration with Wei Wang at Stanford, who is a postdoc in David Bostock's lab and a former UCSF graduate student. And the chip-on-chip data, Yigal, who is a biophysics student, is involved in analyzing chip-on-chip data. And Randy, another biophysics student, is involved in analyzing combination overlap between modules. Thank you.
For the SYN1 and the NDT80 intersection, you think that most of the 17 genes in the intersection had an overlapping site?
Yeah, it looks like. Another interesting thing is that because Hershkovitz's lab recently did an in vitro binding experiment of NDT80. So they basically mutate, they go mutate every base and then measure binding affinity. When they do this, they only see CAC WWW. Once you go off the CAC core, there's no more information there in terms of the binding specificity of NDT80. But when you look at this sporulation gene that goes on, GTGT, that's actually another part of someone binding site. I'm pretty convinced that's the case.
In fact, in our paper on reduce, we did some kind of Purwin's wave matrix, kind of Purwin's version of what you did more systematically by looking at the effect on the expression of the base in the flanking region. And in fact, I think there's a table in the paper, I'm not sure, where we found exactly these TG repeats upstream.
For that NDT80 example.
Right. So we started from the CSC, RCAA, W motif, and then looked in the effect of flanking motifs.
I remember. So you did that single base mutation, and then you look at how that changes the fitting coefficient.
Right.
So we did it in a more systematic way. And also because of the chip on chip data, that's how we discovered the overlap between NDT80 and the SOM1 module.
Right. So it's interesting that this, in a way, proves that there's really a heterodimer that's binding it. Whereas we had no idea, you know, what caused this bias.
Yeah.
Is it things bind together? Or
is it heterodimer, or he was saying?
I think it's one or another. I think it's competitive.
Or it may be competitive. So, I mean, all we could infer from this earlier thing is that there was an effect on if you had a
T. It's certainly known.
It was higher expression.
There is a paper on NDT80 regulation. It's certainly known in that case for NDT80, it's competitive. Because you don't want to turn on NDT80 early on during sporulation, and that's suppressed by someone. That's something we want to do it now, right? We're just beginning to do this systematic screening on that, but just a few examples we pick up. We haven't carefully looked at the spacing between them. This is the only example that we look at that actually overlap. We definitely see lots of overlapping modules even before we do systematic analysis. Like the one I mentioned, the cisplatin resistance, SYN5, and the PDR ones. Haploid, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you asking?
So it depends on YB. And I'm wondering whether you found any motive that sort of distinguishes between sort of YB dependent response.
That's interesting. We don't know.
I'm also sort of curious whether for things like MacA or there are any binding sites known or can it be figured out this way. And I looked up in your database and for MacAlpha, I found some binding sites.
Which one, by MAC?
MCM1 and
MCM1.
Various combinations actually drive this plug dependent gene expression. And for some of them, there is not that much data on what motifs they bind. So I'm just wondering whether this analysis actually picks up some of these distinctions between responses in
that. Right, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, we should go to lunch.
Thank you again.